today, so I really don't want to waste too much time. Let's get started. It's been a few weeks, so we have to put ourselves back into where we were at. If I'm not mistaken, the last thing we did was we started to explore the whole discussion of Malchus from the perspective of Sefer Shmuel. We began to expand our picture. Up until now, we've talked about the dichotomy and the issues and the tension in Sefer Shmuel itself, perhaps the relationship between Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Shoftim. And then we began to explore on a broader scale the question of the attitude towards the notion of Malchus as it appears elsewhere in Tanakh, and a kind of sense of where the overall issue of Tanakh is at vis-a-vis Malchus. I've said at the very beginning of the outset of this unit that one of the most significant issues that covers all of Nach is this subject of Malchus, and so I felt that it was appropriate to take more than just the study of the text or the perek itself, but really to take a couple of shiurim and to explore this beyond the scope of just the text of our perek. And we began by looking at the terminology of Malchus in Chumash. If you remember, we had a discussion about the relationship between the word Melech and the word Nasi, correct? Well, we had a whole discussion about the concept of a Nasi. What's the difference between a Melech and a Nasi? Why is it that the Torah talks about a Nasi? The Torah, at least in Sefer Shmos, Vayikra and Bamidbar, doesn't seem to refer to a Melech. The notion of Melech doesn't begin to enter into the conversation until the end of Sefer Bamidbar, the beginning of Sefer Devarim. We'll talk about that at a later time. But certainly the equivalent in the Torah to the concept of a Shofet is a Nasi, and the Shofet gets replaced by a Melech. So the conversation really begins with an understanding of what is the difference between a Shofet and a Melech, or in our case, in the case of the terminology of the Chumash, what's the difference between a Nasi and a Melech. And that's sort of where I think we left off. We talked a little bit about the notion of Mechilat Kavod, the notion that the Melech represents the people, and therefore his Kavod is demanded of the people. He can't forego that status and that stature, and that opens up a possibility of corruption as well, because where's the boundary lines? Where's the border? If he can insist on his... If he's not allowed to forego that Kavod, then where does the boundaries lie between that which he is entitled to and that which he's obligated in and that which he's corrupt by taking out beyond the boundary of what is required. And that's really what opens... That was the last thing we discussed, was the notion of the parameters to that issue, and the ease by which the notion of kavod and mechilat kavod can be corrupted in the role of the melech, and yet that role being so important to the concept of leadership overall and the representation of the people of Israel as the leader of Israel. I think that was the last thing we did before we took a few week break. Correct? Mm-hmm. Yes? No? Maybe. Sure. I don't know if you remember it, but
as my Bubby would say, why not?
I don't know if you remember it. My recorder remembers it very well. So that's sort of where we left off. What I wanted to just to sort of map out where we're going with all of this, because it's been this is already our sixth shiur on the subject of Malchus, which is in my notes it's about a 10-week or 10 sort of mini-series, just to give you a picture of it. What I would like to do in the short class that we're going to have today is begin the subject of looking at other places in Tanakh where the subject of Malchus is discussed and see and understand the same ambivalence, the same duality that we find, positive and negative, towards the role of Malchus that we saw from the very beginning of our discussion in the rabbinic sources, in the Psak Halacha, And then we're going to work our way backwards. We started in Sefer Shmuel, we went to Chazal, then we went back to Chumash, and we're going to Navi, and we're going to go back to Chumash, because I want to go back to the subject of where Malchus begins in Chumash itself. Where does the Torah begin to explore Malchus? It's not just in the Parsha of the Melech and Sefer Dvarim. We're going to look at that a little bit. And once we're done with all of that, then we're going to go on to Perek Tet in Sefer Shmuel, because up until now we've been doing Perek Tet. Perek Tet is the choice of Shaul as Melech, Perek Tet and Yud, and there we're going to see a completely different picture in Sefer Shmuel. And that sort of completes our discussion of the ambivalence and the dichotomy that we find in the duality that we find in our attitude towards Malchus, and ultimately the reflection of the fact that there's two approaches, because there are good kings and there are bad kings, and ultimately that's where it comes down to. Okay, so that's sort of the map. Let's begin. I want to jump. We're going to do a series of selections from different parts of Nevi'im today, time permitting. Whatever we don't finish, we'll finish next week, to explore the various approaches to, or attitudes, I should say, towards the institution of Melech. And the Dafka, I want to start from the perhaps the most negative, and we'll work our way back to the positive. I'm going to start with Sefer Yechezkel. So a word of introduction about Sefer Yechezkel. Who was Yechezkel? When did he live? And what do we know about him?
So you're not going back to the Chumash.
We will eventually. We're going to do this backwards. We're going to go to Navi and then back to Chumash. Not today, but over the next week or two. We're going to start from selections in Nevi'im, just to round off the picture, and then we're going to go back to Chumash.
Has the show marked some point that's different than everything else?
Shaul?
No, I mean Shlomo.
You mean Shmuel? Who are you talking about?
Yeah.
No, Shmuel, I think in Shmuel you'll find the same ambivalence. You'll find the same duality that you're going to find everywhere else. You're going to find in Sefer Shmuel too. The good and the bad. Or as they say, as the expression goes, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Mm-hmm. Right? You'll have it all. There is no answer.
I guess I'm just trying to get a kind of a picture.
Right. I can map it out for you, but the truth is that there is no consensus. There's no bottom line. Because that's exactly the problem. When the kings were good, there was a sense that there was an energy around the kings and that they represented something positive, and they spoke for the children of Israel, and they spoke for the pride of Israel and the pride of the Jewish people. When the kings were corrupt and the kings were bad, so then you wished for days when you didn't have to worry about a king. Right? So it's not, at the risk of getting political, which I try not to do, it's not too dissimilar to situations where you have a government whose policies you like and you have a government whose policies you don't like. Your sense of pride in an identity rises and falls in accordance with your comfort zone in terms of the behavior of the government. If your leaders behave in a manner that is corrupt and oppressive, your sense of despair rises. When the leaders behave in a manner that is praiseworthy and successful and energetic and strong, your sense of pride rises. So I don't think there's anything surprising here. It gets translated into the language of kingship or Malchus, because the alternative to Malchus wasn't anarchy. The alternative to Malchus was Shofet. I'm not a student of political science, but from a little bit of what I remember back in the old days the study of American history and constitution, the conversation around the Shofet versus Melech wasn't too dissimilar to the tension around, in the early years of the establishment of the United States, around the question of centralized federal government versus state government. Did you put the power of leadership into the hands of the local state level, or did you put the power of government in the hands of the federal government? Were you afraid of the corruption and the power of the federal government? Did you want to keep it localized? And I mean, those kinds of tensions have existed in every form of government since. And the Shofet versus Melech debate wasn't too dissimilar. A shofet was essentially regional. They were accountable. They were the nasi. They were responsible to the tribe. There was much more they were much more democratic because they were connected to the families and to the tribes that asked them to be their leaders. Whereas the melech, who sat in the palace, in the capital, in the one place over the entire country, who could easily be disconnected from the heartbeat of the people, that's what you got. And so there were times when the balance of and preference was to the melech and to that sense of power that the melech represented, army, strength, international relationships, significant stature in the eyes of the world. And there were times when the balance shifted towards the shofet model, or in the language of the Torah, the nasi model, because it was much smaller, much less of a risk of arrogance, much less of a risk of corruption of power. Right? When the Torah talks about the nasiim, every nasi belonged to a different shevet. The nasi had to rise from the ranks of the shevet. It was a much more democratic process, and therefore a much more accountable process. And the nasi could be replaced, and the nasi could be machal on his kavod, and therefore could be accountable for when he didn't forego that kavod. So all of these factors play a role in the dynamic of the role of melech, the background to this whole issue. All right, that's by way of political science commentary. But I guess you can't really study Tanakh without some conversation around it. Who and what is Yechezkel? When did he live, and what do we know about him?
At the time of the exile.
Right, so Yechezkel is the only Navi that we have whose story is essentially the Jews in Bavel in the breach between the First Temple and Second Temple. Yechezkel starts his tenure at the very end of the First Temple period. He's in Bavel. He's together with the Jews in Bavel who go into exile a decade before the destruction of the temple. There's two exiles, one that goes earlier than the other. He goes with the first exile. He's there. His message is to the community of Israel in Bavel. He watches the Churban from afar. And he has two tasks. One is to explain to the people in Bavel that the destruction is coming, that they're not the only ones, that the Yerushalayim is also going to be destroyed. And the other is to give them hope for their ability to return. No Navi speaks about the return to Israel in more and redemption, geula, physical return to the land of Israel, the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. No Navi addresses those issues more and more directly than Yechezkel, because he lives it. He's sitting there with the Jewish community in the generation after the destruction, and he's got to find a way to give them hope that they will return to the land of Israel, both physically, spiritually. They will rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. The entire last section of Sefer Yechezkel, almost a third of the Sefer almost, is devoted entirely to a depiction of the what we refer to as the Third Temple. Yechezkel didn't call it the Third Temple. He called it the Next Temple, because he wasn't expecting there to be another destruction. But his depiction of what they would rebuild when they would return to the land of Israel, including the Beit HaMikdash, is very detailed.
So how many people were living with him that decade before, and how many were left in Jerusalem?
That's a study of Sefer Malachim. It gets complicated. We don't know for sure the numbers. We know that initially there's tens of thousands that go into exile. We don't know what happened. The northern tribes had gone into exile 100 years earlier. There's all kinds of different groups involved. And then there's the destruction of the temple, and the rest of the community gets exiled by Bavel to Bavel, so then they're joined by the rest of the community. There's a remnant left in Israel. We don't necessarily know numbers, but certainly Yechezkel, the center of the community is with Yechezkel for the bulk of the time. After Yechezkel, you have Daniel, and you have the story of Esther and Mordechai, and then ultimately the return under Ezra and Nehemiah, and the rebuilding of the Second Temple. has chronologically, Yechezkel is first, then you have the story of Daniel in Bavel, then you have, at some point or another, the story of Mordechai in Persia, because Persia conquers Bavel, and then the return from Babylonia, the Persian exile, because as Persia conquers Bavel. We go from the Babylonian exile to the Persian exile without blinking an eye, and without moving. Right? Because Bob...
Yeah, they stayed in... Well, most of them stayed in...
Because we stayed where we were, because that Bavel was conquered by Persia. All right. Yechezkel speaks about... Yechezkel speaks in a very easy Hebrew. Unlike some of the other Nevi'im, whose Hebrew is much more complicated, Yechezkel is actually one of the easiest Nevi'im to understand because his language is easier. And he speaks about different things. One of the issues that we're going to look at is his approach to or his description of the restoration of Jewish sovereignty. How does he describe the restoration of Malchut Yisrael? Because the understanding or the expectation is that when we return to the land of Israel, we will reestablish Jewish sovereignty, Melech HaMashiach. We call the Mashiach Melech HaMashiach. We do that for a reason. Because Mashiach means anointed one, and Melech HaMashiach is exactly what he's going to be. Melech, right? That's how we expect to understand. That's how the Rambam describes it. Melech HaMashiach atid la'amod le'Yisrael. So let's take a look at Yechezkel. Perak Lamed Dalet. We're going to read a good part of the whole paragraph. 52. You know what? Let me do something else. Before we go to Lamed Dalet, we're going to do this backwards. Do everything else backwards. Well, let's do this backwards too. Let's go to Lamed Zayin first. Lamed Zayin, Perek, Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Tet Vav. We read this Perek as the Haftorah of Parshat Vayigash. It's the second half of the Nevuah of the Dry Bones. Remember the story of the prophecy of the dry bones, where Yechezkel sees a cemetery of dry bones, and he prophesies that these dry bones will come back to life, the resurrection of the people of Israel. That's the first half of this parak. The second half, starting with Pasuk Tet Vav, is the restoration of Jewish sovereignty. You ever have it? Everybody have it? Lamed Zayin Tet Vav 37:15. Everybody have it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Vahid Dvar Hashem Elai Lemor. Viata Ben Adam. Kach Lecha Etz Echa Duchtov Ata Alav Liuda Livnei Yisrael Chaverav. Ulkach Etz Echa Duchtov Alav Liyosef Etz Ephraim Mecho Beit Yisrael Chaverav. What's he describing here? Yechezkel is known for all kinds of visual tactics. He describes his prophecies not only in words but also in visual acts. So he's told to take a stick, and on it to write Yehuda and Bnei Yisrael Chaverav. And on the second staff, he's told to write Yosef, Eitz Ephraim, and all of Israel. In other words, each stick would represent
the two kingdoms.
One would represent Yehuda, the other would represent Yisrael. Ephraim or Yisrael.
Is it significant that one is the children and one is the house? Or is that just...
No, I don't think so. But one is Yehuda, one is Yosef. And what's significant is that it's been written on an eitz, on a piece of wood. Why? Because a stick... or a staff always represents, as a symbol, represents leadership. Right? Represents a tree, represents a genealogical tree. Right? We think of Moshe with the staff. Staff is a symbol of leadership. That's exactly right. V'karavotam echad el echad lecha le'etz echad. Take these two staffs, take these two sticks, and bring them together. V'hayu la'achadim biyadecha. They will be forged into one stick in your hands. Take these two pieces of wood, put them together, and they become one. When Bnei Yisrael will say to you, what is this? What does this mean? You shall say to them thus, I'm going to take the staff of Yosef, meaning the leadership of Yosef, and of Ephraim, and all of the tribes who are with them representing the kingdom of Israel. And over them I will place the staff of Yehuda. They will become one. They will become one in my hand. This isn't just words. You have to have these sticks in front of them. You have to show them this visually. Now, go back to the previous half of the chapter, just review for a moment. The first half of this chapter is the story of the dry bones. In the story of the dry bones, Yechezkel sees these bones come back to life, form a great army, and return to the land of Israel as a symbol of the restoration of the people of Israel to the land of Israel. So every nevuah of Yechezkel is going to start with that vision. Every conclusion is going to start with the steps of redemption, start with the return of the people to the land. And then we go on from there. I'm going to take the Bnei Yisrael out of the nations to which they have gone. Yechezkel's in exile. Yechezkel's with them in Bavel. So the Nevuah of Geula always has to start with Kibbutz Galiot, the ingathering of the exiles. I will bring them from the gathering from the four corners of the earth, bring them to their land. That's common to all the Nevuot of Yechezkel. I will make them one nation in the land, in the mountains of Israel. They will have one king. They will no longer be two nations. They will no longer be two kingdoms. They will no longer defile themselves with all the idolatry. I will purify them, they will be my nation. Now, listen to what happens next. Pasuk of Talit. My servant David will be their leader, will be their king. V'ro'e echad yel chulam, one shepherd. U'v'mishpatai elechu v'v'chukotai yishmeru v'asuotam, my laws they will follow. V'yashvu la'aretz ashenatati la'avdil Yaakov, asher yashvu ba'avotechem, they will remain in the land that I promised to the forefathers. V'yashvu aleha hemu v'nehem u'v'nehem v'nehem ad olam, they will stay there for eternity. Next line. The Avdi David Nasi Lahem Le'olam. What has Yechezkel just done? He's appointed a king. The king will be a descendant of Beit David.
But he combined king and
he shifts from Melech to Nasi. Yechezkel is the only Navi to speak of the restoration of Malchut Yisrael as the restoration of Nasi Yisrael. And it's intentional. Because the center of gravity in Yechezkel's Nevuot are always around the Nasi, not the Melech. Very rare do we find Yechezkel using the term Melech. The term that he uses more often than anything else is Nasi. I I will make my, I will place my mikdash in their midst. I will place my mishkan in them. The rest of the references to the mishkan we're going to skip. Another example. Jump backwards. Now we'll go back to Perek Lamed Dalet. Before we get to the whole parak, let's look at one pasuk, Chaf Gimel, 23. Everybody have it? Lamed Dalet Chaf Gimel? Vakimoti alehem. Vakimoti alehem ro'e echad. I will appoint over them one shepherd. Same theme. Right? It's a parallel nevuah. It starts from a different perspective. V'ra'a eten et avdi David. David, my servant, or his descendant, will be their shepherd. Hu yir'e otam. He will shepherd them. Hu yalehem lo'e. He will be their shepherd. The reason there's this constant emphasis on the word shepherd, I'll show you in a moment. V'ani eshem heye lehem lelokim. V'avdi David. Nasi betocham ani Hashem dimayti. That's Yechezkel's message. We're going to restore Israel to the land of Israel. We're going to restore Jewish sovereignty. We're going to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. But the institution of leadership that Yechezkel envisions is not the institution of Melech. It's David, it's Beit David, it's a descendant of House of David. We can call it Melech if we want. It's still a continuity, a continuation of the lineage of David HaMelech. But for reasons that are self-evident to the people at the time, there's an inherent fear, a natural fear, of the concept of HaMelech, the power of HaMelech. The fact that the Malchei Yisrael, for the most part, led them into this mess. Why would they want to restore an institution that led them into the abyss of exile in the first place? And so in Yechezkel's vision of what's going to be fixed, he'll fix the Beit HaMikdash, and they'll fix the land of Israel, and they'll fix the security of Israel. And one of the things they're going to fix is the institution of leadership. And that institution of leadership is going to be modeled after the Nasi, not after the Melech. The Nasi is more accountable. The Nasi is more democratic.
So is that why Ro'eh is brought in before?
No. The Ro'eh is the whole parak.
Right.
So let's go back to the beginning of this parak. The beginning of this parak is very powerful.
Why did you go backwards like that? Why did you go 3 pages and 4 pages? Why did you go there and then come back to this?
Because there he talks about restoration of Malchus, and then in that same breath he talks about Nasi. So I wanted to introduce it there first. And then we'll come back to see this parak and how it just... Yeah, no reason. In my notes, I have it the other way around, but I just... out of whim. Out of whim.
Why not? Yeah. So you can ask.
There's no chronology
so
to these... there's a chronology, but it's not relevant to us.
So
that's right. Let's take a look at this parak. This parak really... this is the foundation of Yechezkel's vision of the leadership of Israel. Beginning of Perek Lamed Dalet. Vehi Dvar Hashem Elai Lemor. Ben Adam. Hineve al Ro'e Yisrael. Prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Who are the shepherds?
Kings.
The kings. This nevuah is a nevuah of critique against the kings of Israel and the corruption of the kings. He does not refer to them as Melech once. He refers to them as shepherds. And whether they lived by or abandoned or corrupted their responsibility, but their responsibility is defined as that of a
shepherd.
Who's the flock?
In
Israel. Hineve al ro'e Yisrael. Hineve v'amarta alehem. La'ro'im. To the shepherds. Koma Hashem Elokim. Hoi ro'e Yisrael. Woe unto you, shepherds of Israel. Asher hayu ro'im otam, who were they shepherding?
The
They shepherd themselves. Halohatzon yiru aroim. Who are the shepherds supposed to shepherd?
The flock.
Et achelev tochelu. Vetatzemer tilbashu. Habri'ah tizbachu. Hatzon lo tiru. And you ate your fat. You dressed in the clothes of the wool. You fattened yourselves. And as for the flock, did you care for them? Did you provide for them? Et hanachalot lo chizaktem. Et hanachlot lo chizaktem. You did not strengthen the weak. Et hachola lo ripitem. Nor did you heal the sick. Velanishberet lo chavashtem. Nor did you bound the cripple. Veta nidachat lo hashevotem. Nor have you brought back those who were taken captive. Veta ovedet lo bikashtem. You did not seek those who were lost. You ruled them with cruelty and with force. Vatifutzena mi bliwa'e. The response was, the result was, that they were scattered because of a lack of shepherding. They became food for the beasts of the field. If you're carrying through the metaphor of Israel as a flock of sheep, in a positive sense, then if you don't have a strong shepherd, what happens to them?
They wander all over.
They wander through the forest and they become vulnerable to the beasts of the field. My sheep were wandered through the mountains. And over every hill. And my flock was dispersed over the earth. None seek them, none look after them.
Who's he speaking to here? There are no kings of Israel.
Correct. Nevi'im never spoke specifically to, or they didn't necessarily have to speak specifically. Wow. So Nevu'ah about, when the Nevi'im spoke to the nations of the world, Nevu'ah to Edom, Nevu'ah to Ammon, to Nevu'ah to Mitzrayim, right? They were messages that were conceptual.
But some of the Nevi'im
sometimes
spoke to the king.
Yes,
Yahushua spoke to the king. Yirmiyahu spoke to the king.
Some, and sometimes they spoke generically to... L'chein ro'im shimu dvar Hashem. Chai aninu m'Hashem Elokim. Im lo ya'an heyot tzoni levaz. As I live, says God, because my flock has become a prey. V'tiyena tzoni l'ochla l'chol chayat ha'sadeh. And my flock has become prey for food for every beast of the field. Me'ein ro'eh, because there was no shepherd. V'lo darshu ro'ayat tzoni. And my shepherds did not seek my flock. Remember the Medrash about the choice of Moshe Rabbeinu because he went running after the lost sheep? We'll see that in Sha'ul as well. The shepherds shepherd themselves rather than my people. Yechezkel repeats himself a lot. Baruch Agav. L'chein ha-ro'im shimu dvar Hashem. Komar Hashem Elokim. Hineni al ha-ro'im. I set myself against the shepherds. I will hold them accountable for my flock. I will put an end to their feeding the sheep. They will no longer shepherd themselves. What will I do to them? I will end them. I will destroy them. I will no longer allow them to be the leaders. I will save my flock from them so that my flock will no longer be destroyed. I will search my sheep. I will seek them out. Listen to the next phrase. Kivakarat ro'e edro. Like a shepherd seeks his flock, biyom heyoto betoch tzono nifrashot, on the day that his sheep have strayed, kein avaker et tzoni, I will seek out my sheep, v'itzalti otam mikol ha'makamot asher nafotu sham biyom anan va'arafel, I will deliver them from all the places they have been dispersed in the days of darkness. He's going to get to the ingathering of the exiles in a moment, but notice the phrase kivakarato e'edro. Where does that come from? Where are we familiar with it from? Say it again. Yes, where?
I knew it was in davening. That's pretty good.
Uh-huh.
somewhere.
I'll finish the phrase for you. Kvakaratu edro mavir tzono tachat shifto. Kain ta'avir v'tispor v'timne. Where's it from? No. Kevakarat ro'e edro, like a shepherd counts his flock.
That's in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur davening.
It's the central line of Unatana Tokef. Now, in Unatana Tokef, the imagery is a Kadosh Baruch Hu judging every flock, every sheep, every individual member of Klal Yisrael one by one. But the phrase in its source, which is here, is a message that's almost the exact opposite. Not that God is judging each individual sheep, but rather he is searching for each individual sheep to bring them home because the shepherds were delinquent in their duties. So God will step in to be the shepherd who will gather his flock, like a shepherd who counts his scattered flock and brings them home. See the difference? Now we're back to that same theme I told you about before. Every Nevuah of Yechezkel begins with in gathering of the exiles. I will gather them from the nations. I will gather them from the lands. I will bring them to their land. I will shepherd them on the mountains of Israel. I will shepherd them. I will bring them into good grazing lands. There they will prosper in beautiful, fat lands. Who's going to be their shepherd? I will be their shepherd because the shepherds were delinquent. The one who was lost, I will seek. And the oppressed, I will return. And I will take the one who is broken, and I will heal them. No. That's part of the problem. You had a few good kings. You had good kings. But in the over, where are they now? They're sitting in exile. Why are they sitting in exile? Because in the balance of it, the good kings were not able to outweigh the bad kings, and ultimately the people that were led to idolatry. In particular, the worst of the kings were towards the end. So when Yechezkel is looking back on the abandonment of the kings, when the kings abandoned the people, the worst offenders were the kings towards the end.
But he still lumps the whole thing together.
Yep. And then in the end he says, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, after he will bring all the flock back, he will then judge the flock, because once you bring the people back to Israel, you then have to judge them, the good ones, the loyal ones, from the ones who abandoned his path. And so, Pasuk Chaf, Lachain Komar Hashem Elokim Alehem. Inini ani v'shefati ben seu v'riyahu ben seraza. I will judge between the fat cattle and between the lean cattle, meaning between those who are loyal and those who are not. Yam betzadu v'katef te'edafu. Skip a little bit. V'shati l'tzoni v'lotiena od levaz. I will save my flock. They will no longer be prey. V'shefatiti ben selase. I will judge between one sheep and another, meaning in the Shemoneh Esrei, we have a series of brachas in the Shemoneh Esrei that talk about the Geula. Mm-hmm. Correct? Mm-hmm. We start with after Baruch Aleinu, Baruch Hashanim, Tekah B'Shofar Gadol L'Cherutenu, right? To bring the Mekabetz Nidcha Yisrael. Correct? Gathering of the exiles. What's the next bracha in the Shemoneh Esrei after Mekabetz Nidcha Yisrael? Baruch Adonai Hashem, Mekabet Nidchei Amo Yisrael. Next bracha. Should flow. Hashiva Shoftayich Kevarishona V'yoatzayich Kevatchila. To return the judges the restoration of the institution of Mishpat. And then we have two more brachas that talk about v'lamalshinim al titikva, the judging of the wicked, and v'letzadikim, right, the restoration of Mishan Miftach Latzadikim. In other words, the part of the process of the redemption is that once you return the people to the land, then you have to hold the people accountable for all of their mistakes. You can't do that in exile. You can once they're back in the land of Israel. So step one is it's Kibbutz Galiot. Step two is the restoration of institutions of judgment, of Mishpat, Beit Din. And then that Beit Din can then judge between the righteous and the wicked, between the Lamal Shinim and between the Tzadikim. And then, once that's all done, what's the next step? What's the bracha after Mishana Miftach Latzadikim?
It's
B'nei Yerushalayim. B'nei Yerushalayim, followed by? B'nei Yerushalayim. Tzemach David. So the notion of the restoration of David HaMelech and the institution of Malchut Yisrael, or whatever remnant, or whatever form it will take, is the very end of the process. Step one is the physical return to the land of Israel. Step two is the restoration of judgment between righteous and wicked. Then Bonei Yerushalayim, which is a reference to the Beit HaMikdash. And then at the very end, it's Tzemach David Avdecha Merat Atzmeach. The Gemara Megillah says that there's a whole discussion in the Gemara Megillah that describes that sequence as intentional, because Gula has to take place in those stages, and there's a constant search for the source for that sequence. One of the references, not on the Gemara, but one of the clearest indications of the source of that sequence is in Sefer Yechezkel, because he uses that sequence over and over and over again. Step one is the restoration of the exiles. Step two, the holding of the leadership accountable. Old leadership, new leadership. The old leadership, the Ro'im, who fed themselves rather than the people. New leadership, God will step in, hold the people accountable, but God can't lead a people. You have to have some leader. So then you have Pasuk Chav Gimel, Vakimoti Alehem Ro'e Echad, one shepherd. V'ra'atenet Avdi David, my servant David, will shepherd them. Hu yir'e otam, he will shepherd them. Hu yelehem lo'e, he will be their shepherd. V'ani Hashem yelehem lo'kim v'avdi David nasi betocham. Understand the context? The reference, Yechezkel's constant reference to the leadership of Israel as a nasi, or as a ro'e, is precisely in contrast to the corruption of the leadership of the older generation. Because they were kings who fed themselves rather than feeding the people, because they were kings who cared for themselves rather than for the people, they led the people into exile. The restoration of leadership has to be accountable. Has to be accountable to the people. They have to be shepherds who are going to care about the people. They have to be a nasi, whether legally or otherwise, but they have to have that sense of accountability that the nasi had, that a melech never had.
First place it says
Avdi David? No. He calls him that throughout the Sefer.
No, I mean right here.
In this parak. This is the conclusion of this parak. Wait.
So yeah. Is Hashem going to do the judging?
So that's a very...
He's going to carry out this judgment.
Right, so that's an interesting question related to a much broader context of what does that mean? Is it metaphorical? Is it literal? That's a conversation for
a different time.
A different context. In the Shemoneh Esrei, we talk about a Shiva Shoftayach Kevavishana, the restoration of the Sanhedrin. Okay. That's Yechezkel. So, in the question with which we began, if you had to picture Yechezkel's approach to Malchut Yisrael, on the one hand, he does talk about the restoration of Malchut Beit David and the image with which he sees it reconstituted. On the other hand, Yechezkel has done everything he can to reframe that malchus to address the ills, if you will, that permeated malchus version 1, let's call it. which failed. It failed to the people. It failed because it split the people into two kingdoms. Can't have a nation divided into two. So part of Yechezkel's vision is the restoration of unity of leadership. He does not subscribe to the Shofet model of every Shevet having its own leader. So it's Nasi Echad al Kulam. It's one. It's the Avdi David. On the other hand, it's a Nasi, not a Melech. Nasi is different. He's a Shofet, but he's not a Shofet. He's a Nasi. He's a Melech. It's unclear. So he's trying to take the best of all worlds. He's trying to take the accountability of the institution of the Nasi and infuse it into the nationality, broad context of single leadership of Malchus. There you see the culmination of the struggle. All right. We're going to stop.
People accept that. Isn't that a major issue? They'll accept this Nasi versus the Melech.
So, call it what you will, right? But what he's essentially talking about is the restoration of Malchus, but in a form that's more accountable to both the Torah and to the people. That's a dream.
Okay.
Can we get there? Debatable. But that's the dream. All right. We will stop here. Next week we will look at Yeshayahu and Micha.